Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. What is a Middle Eastern American? What does it mean? And does it have anything to do with the broad stereotypes that pervade much of our popular culture, especially since September 11th, 2001? Joining us to talk about that is sociologist Dr. Mehdi Bozorgme. He is founding co-director of the Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Also with us is Jonathan Friedlander. He's assistant director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Both will be speaking later today on the OSU campus. For more information, you can go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. So let's just jump right in and try to figure out what do we know about the demographics of Middle Eastern Americans today and how it's changed over time.
Okay, the first thing is to clarify what is this category. Okay, and there's, as we know, there's really not a Middle Eastern category in American lexicon, like Asian Americans or Latinos or Hispanics. You know, some of it has sort of emerged after 9/11, but even that has been expressed or worded or framed in terms of Arabs and Muslims. So the first important thing is what is the Middle Eastern, you know, American? And one way to think about it is sort of to think about what is the Middle East and what are the different sort of ethnic and nationalities there. So you can think about it in terms of Arabs, right? Iranians, Israelis, and Turks. And that's sort of the broad, you know, sort of categories
that reach back over the
to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And within them, you know, you have all these sort of ethno-religious minorities. So contrary to what we think about the Middle East as a monolithic, predominantly Muslim, you know, place, but you have, you know, Christians, you have Jews, you have Zoroastrians, you have other religious groups, you have ethnic groups like Kurds, like, you know, and variety of other. So all of those groups are here. And what is really interesting and important to think about it is because of this phenomenon that is called migrant selectivity, some of those groups are even overrepresented vis-a-vis the populations back home. So, for instance, in Iran, you know, the religious minorities comprised less than 2% of the population before the revolution, but they're disproportionately overrepresented here, particularly in places like Los Angeles. So you have not just Muslims, but you have a very sizable community of Iranian Jews, Iranian Armenians, Iranian, you know, the Assyrians, Zoroastrians, Baha'is, and so on and so forth.
You also have to remember that the populations have changed over a course of more than a century, that the migration started at the latter part of the 19th century and accelerated in the early part of the 20th century. And there was a hiatus from 1924 to 1965, you know, with the restrictions on immigration, and then an explosion of immigration from the Middle East in post-1965 era. We should not forget there's also a very large Armenian population who came here, you know, after in the wake of the genocide. So it's a complicated story, and most people try to simplify it by not understanding the nuances and the multi-tiered characteristics of these population.
That first wave, when you say latter part of the 19th century, that's, you know, well into then the Industrial Revolution.
Right, and urbanization and industrialization, immigration, these the forces of the late 19th century, and that brought essentially Christians from Mount Lebanon to New York and the East Coast. And
Arab Christians,
of course. And then, of course, Armenian Christians came in the first decade of the 20th century to California, to the East Coast. So there's lots of work on these populations. But now we have a very diverse Middle Eastern American population, and it's this population that we are focusing today.
When it started out in the first waves, it wasn't as diverse as it is now. Well, so with each wave represents another iteration.
Yeah, I mean, just the same situation with other groups, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what really happened in the post-65 era is that, you know, you have, of course, the sort of the changing policies vis-a-vis immigration, opening the doors to people from other places than the Western Hemisphere. But at the same time, you have a lot of events in the region. And I think what is really important about the Middle Eastern American experience is not just the pull factors, but also the push factors. The push factors clearly is the sort of massive industrialization that's happening in parts of the in many parts of the Middle East, particularly oil-producing countries. You know, the oil revenues encouraging industrialization, encouraging. At the same time, you know, you really don't have the educational infrastructure. So students came out, a very big wave of students. A lot of immigrant professionals have come in, entrepreneurs have come in, and the population has really diversified. I mean, now you have people coming from many countries in the Middle East and North Africa, and you know, and that is a very, very, before you had Arabs and Armenians, but now you have all these other groups, like, for instance, Iranians, Israelis, Turks. These are sort of new immigrant streams.
My guests are Dr. Mehdi Borzorgmehr. He's professor of sociology. He's a founding co-director of the Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Also, Jonathan Friedlander, assistant director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. We're talking about Middle Eastern Americans. Who are they? What does it mean to America? If you are a Middle Eastern American, or if you're the child of a Middle Eastern immigrant and you're a new American, whatever iteration you want to pick, give us a call and tell us your story and what it's been like for you in the United States. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides if you want to take that route. There is the assumption or there's the stereotype that most are Arab.
Yes.
And that's not the case, but it...
And most are Muslim.
And most are Muslim,
right.
Too. Right. What difference does that make to everything when we have those kind of skewed notions about what the makeup is?
Well, it's quite a bit of reductionism and essentializing these populations. And unfortunately, these are not popular categories, you know, so there's tons of stereotypes. There's sort of Islamophobia is on the rise in the U.S. and, you know, also in Europe. And not to suggest that, you know, that, I mean, and the important thing is that not all Arabs are Muslims, neither are all Muslims Arabs. So there's a problem neither in the Middle East nor here. So
does this notion play into the question you often hear, and we were hearing it again this week after the protests really around the world almost about that film? A lot of times people say, why don't Middle Easterners in the United States speak out and, you know, call out these people who are, you know, that kill our ambassador in Syria, you know, why in Libya? Why don't they call them out? And I'm wondering if that diversity is what's lost on people.
Actually,
but not everybody identifies with what's going on.
Actually, that's not true.
Okay.
that's the first, that's the sort of a misunderstanding. In fact, if you look at the response of Middle Easterners, Arabs and Muslim communities right after every virtually incident that involves, you know, these populations. They condemn it. They're very, very... Muslim Political Action Committee right away issued statements condemning it. You know, and I think the problem with these populations, and we've heard this when we've interviewed community leaders, is that they say they never hear us. And they keep saying, like, for instance, one major, major leader told us that no matter how many times I've condemned the terrorist attacks, they still say, why don't you denounce it? Why don't you condemn? So partly is that it just sort of falls on deaf ears. It's also, not that they don't do it.
Also, there's a, in addition to the notion of this backlash, you have to understand that American popular culture has influenced the way we think about the Middle East, by extension, Middle Eastern Americans, you know. The onslaught of television, movies, Harlequin romances, and Dan Brown novels that you see in the airports and in the supermarkets. And I mean, American popular culture is... loves the Middle East in a certain way, you know, and very often stereotypes it. So in addition to what you hear from the Middle East and all the things that you mentioned, there's also an indigenous Orientalist, quote-unquote, industry that feeds these stereotypes. So it's a kind of a double-edged sword. Not only do we have it over there, but we have it from here, made in America. not by Middle Easterners themselves, Middle Eastern Americans themselves, and not through any contributions of Middle Eastern Americans to the output of popular culture, but it's Americans who are producing these. So there's a dialogue that has to occur between Americans and Middle Eastern Americans about shaping their identity as well through popular culture.
You know, you're right. I mean, they do decry it. They do condemn it. And you're right. It does seem to fall on deaf ears. And yet the Pope makes one peep and it's heard around the world. Yeah. That's what I was getting at, is when there's so many different groups within that larger, beneath that umbrella, it's different than what is, you know, clearly more monolithic, although very, very different in itself, the Catholic Church, for instance.
You also have to understand that comparatively, this population is small, smaller than, of course, Asian Americans.
Well, how big is it? Tell us about that.
Well, this is actually one part of the problem. The problem is that the census does not collect data on Middle Easterners directly. There's no Middle Easterners fall under whites in the race category. So when you look at the census form,
they don't have an ethnic breakdown.
There's no breakdown for them. So, but what the census does is that they try to get at this population through the ancestry question, which appears on the American Community Survey, comes out once a year. And the problem with that is that it's a self-reported category. You see, it's not a box you have to fill in. And fill-ins often are sort of very vulnerable to under-reporting. So, for instance, the census, you know, suggests that the American Community Survey suggests that there's a little bit more than 1 million Arabs, but the Arab American sort of institute, you know, estimates that there are three times as many. The census suggests that there's less than 500,000 Iranians, and Iranians suggest that there's at least twice as many, if not more. So there is an underreporting of the numbers. But, you know, certainly they're in the millions. They're not a negligible, insignificant. And they're, because they're very concentrated in states like Michigan, New York, and California, their impact is very, very felt, you know, locally.
My guests are Dr. Mehdi Borzoghmair. He is professor of sociology from the Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Also, Jonathan Friedlander, assistant director at the Center for Near Eastern Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. We'll continue our discussion about Middle Eastern American identities when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Libertarian Party presidential candidate Gary Johnson joins us with his vision for the campaign and the country. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 54 degrees with some sunshine, warming up to 67 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 46. Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting CNN's senior legal analyst and bestselling author Jeffrey Toobin, reading from his latest book, The Oath, The Obama White House versus the Supreme Court, Monday, September 24th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets at thurberhouse.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about Middle Eastern American identities. What does it mean? What does it mean to you? Give us a call and share your story, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Alam Payind, Mehdi Borzoghmair, and Jonathan Friedlander will speak today at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU. For more information, we have a link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Bernie at Ohio State, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bernie.
Hi, Ann. Thanks. Great topic. I was just curious, though. There has been no mention of the Kurdish nations. The Kurdish ethnic group, I guess, covers that area from Turkey to into Iraq. And I'm just wondering, has that ethnic or cultural group why are they not given the same degree of regard?
Well, actually, I did mention the Kurds.
Yes.
And I know you're absolutely right. And this is the problem. The problem is that when we sort of focus on the groups, the larger groups, and the groups that are most sort of affected by the post 9/11 backlash, such as Arabs and Muslims, some of these smaller groups, you know, that fall by the wayside. And another problem is that when you are sort of a stateless people, you know, they tend to kind of somewhat, like the Kurds, you know, or like Assyrians, you know, you never hear about them. But you're absolutely right. And it's very, very important group. And in fact, there are representatives, there are Kurdish minorities from Iran, from Turkey, from Iraq that are here, mostly from Turkey and from Iran. And these groups are, and this is the issue that we are sort of like getting at, is that within a nationality, you have these sub-ethnic groups. So you have the Kurds, you know, and that's a very, very important group to consider, with a distinctive language, although they're mostly Sunni Muslim, but they have their own as a very distinctive ethnic category.
Well, you know, of course, the Kurdish population in the Middle East is quite large. It's one of the largest minority groups in the Middle East. It straddles Syria and Turkey and Iran. But in the United States, they're not as large in numbers. But they're well represented within particular minorities. And Mehdi brings to fore an important issue, which is the notion of sub-ethnicity. So, for example, if you look at Iranian Americans, you would have quote-unquote secular Muslims and observant Muslims, and both, and Iranian Jews and Zoroastrians and Kurds and Baha'is and Assyrians and Armenians. So the whole notion of sub-ethnicity comes into play, and it's an important theoretical issue in the study of immigration when we talk about ethnicity and sub-ethnicity. The same thing can be said about Armenians and Arabs, you know? So, and how is it different from Asian Americans who come from China and Korea and Vietnam and Japan? And so this is an important issue in the study of sociology and history, ethnic studies, multiculturalism. And our mission really is to bring this notion into fore to the general public.
Well, it's a great mission, and I wish you all the best. It's a difficult task, but a necessary one. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie.
Thank you, Bernie. Thanks for the call. If you want to make a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Yeah, good morning. And my question is this. I find that in this country, the judicial system and employers, most of them are prejudiced against the Middle Eastern, especially Iranian. What's your guest's opinion on that, please?
Well, I wouldn't say most are, but there is certainly prejudice and discrimination against these groups. And I think that the important thing is that the two issues that are very important. One is that often these populations don't really have much to do with the source of the problem. It's the events back home that dictate the situation. So when there's anti-Americanism in Iran, you know, right now there's this sort of debacle about the nuclear, sort of development, the Iranians, invariably become scapegoats for that. But increasingly this is changing. And I think the way that's changing is that Americans are learning more about the situation. Iranian-American organization, Iranian-Americans are sort of like educating the public about the population. This is why it's important to keep these distinctions in mind, And of course, I still think that you're absolutely right, that there is, evidence suggests that there is, certain level of prejudice and discrimination, but it's not most.
Also, you have to understand that above and beyond the notion of conflict and discrimination, these groups are part of the American scene. They not all of them face discrimination. The Israeli Americans have a different story, and Armenians have a different story as opposed to the Arabs and Iranians. That these populations are highly educated, entrepreneurial, socially mobile. These are the characteristics that we very rarely hear about. We hear about conflict. And that's all we hear is about conflict. And it's about time to really step away a little bit and see what else is around. Most people know Middle Eastern Americans either at the place of work or as friends, especially in Ohio, which has a strong Arab-American history and heritage. But let's look at these populations, how they contribute to this country, how they provide vitality to this country, and how important they are Let's look at these characteristics and maybe approach the situation not only from a confrontational point of view, because that's how Americans view the Middle East in general, through popular culture and through other venues.
You know, there's black studies departments at most universities. There's women's studies department. And by the way, Nick, thanks for your call. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Nick.
Women's studies, black, African-American studies, that kind of thing. And I don't know to what extent that sort of approach is taken with Middle Eastern history and culture in the United States?
Not at all.
Okay.
And the reason, again, goes back to what we talked about earlier on, that's the issue that they're sort of considered whites. So they're, in fact, Middle Easterners fall between cracks. On the one hand, they're considered white, so there are no ethnic studies. You know, there's no sort of like, just like an Asian American study, there's no Middle Eastern American.
And it's easy. The gender breakdown is easy. That's easy to make the distinction that way. But
And then on the other hand, you have, the Middle East studies centers in the country, like the one at OSU, one of the most sort of funded, and best funded centers in the country. But because they're international studies, they are sort of discouraged from looking at the U.S. scene. So the Middle East studies centers don't deal with them. Ethnic studies centers don't deal with them. Therefore, you know, nobody really deals with them. I mean, certain places where there is a high impact, like, for instance, in, you know, Dearborn, you have University of Michigan
in Michigan,
and Dearborn that
right.
has Arab American studies. And in fact, the reason that we have a Middle Eastern American center is because our original funding was from the Ford Foundation rather than from the U.S. Department of Education. So we could choose whatever category title we wanted for our center.
Jonathan, did you want to add something?
Well, of course, Mehdi's center at City University of New York is the only Middle Eastern American center in the United States. Of course, at UCLA, there's a large Middle Eastern American population, the largest in the United States, in fact, in Southern California. The diversity is immense. But so you have the study of Middle Eastern Americans in particular departments, in sociology, in history, in ethnomusicology, in anthropology, in women's studies. But they're not really focused like Asian American studies or Chicano studies or African American studies, even though the cases that they bring to the academic setting are profound, as we mentioned. And you have to remember also that these populations are very, very connected to the Middle East. More than any other population in the United States, they follow the politics of the Middle East.
Why do you think that is?
But politics are very real, and look at the
they're
newspaper.
So immediate, and they're everywhere in your face.
Yes, and in fact, this is actually another thing that sort of distinguishes them, say, from Asian Americans or Latinos. They're much more connected to the events there. They're more politicized, you know, and they also sort of, invariably get caught in this, you know, the struggles and the conflicts that happen in the Middle East. So
are there any particular educational distinctions? Do they tend to be better educated necessarily or not? Or it just depends on, you know, what their as you put it, their migrant selectivity status was?
Yeah. They tend, overall, it varies from group to group,
right.
But they tend to have high levels of education. They're remarkably entrepreneurial. You know, they're usually about half of the top 10 most entrepreneurial
but
groups.
But that's a cold part of the cultural nature of the country they come from.
Well, they come from culture of entrepreneurship, like
right.
groups like Armenians or Jews
okay.
in the Middle East, you know, but also partly, you know, is because they also have capital, you know, that
mm-hmm.
they bring, and partly is because there are disadvantages in the labor market. You know, if you're an engineer and you cannot get a job, you know, that's commensurate with your qualification, you open a business. You know?
They're also very successful immigrants. They come here with skills. In addition to life skills, their language skills and networking. They're also connected to cohort populations here. So, for example,
what do you mean?
Co-religionists.
Okay. So Israelis, for example, come to the United States. In addition to forming their own particular community, are connected to the large Jewish American community, and the Armenians likewise. And the Muslims have a different trajectory because the Islam, even though it's a fast-growing religion in the United States, so Muslims also have to find their way in the United States. But they don't have this kind of large co-religionist community that they connect with in the same way that, for example, Jews have.
Why is that, though?
Well, you know, we have to be very specific.
Right.
I mean, only Armenian immigrants and Israeli immigrants and other Jewish immigrants have those co-religionist connections.
Right.
Other
mm-hmm.
groups who did not came, you know, earlier. You don't have sort of the, you know, sort of the subsequent generations who are native born that you can connect to. But, you know, the issue with the Muslim is a very complicated category because it's really not unitary. I mean, you have devout Muslims, you have observant Muslims, you have secular Muslims, you have nominal Muslims, you know, and all these groups are here, you know. So it's not, again, we tend to essentialize Muslims, you know, with bearded men and hijabi women, you know, but there's a much more diverse community.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I actually have two questions. One is I was interested in knowing what your caller's opinion is on the media and how they possibly stir up some of the discrimination and the racism that goes along with it. In the sense, what I mean by that mostly is, for example, every time the premier, Ahmadinejad, says anything, and rightfully so, the media jump on it. But mainly the only thing I ever hear that comes out of his mouth is how the Gentiles and the Jews need to be wiped off the face of the earth. So obviously there's a
The Jews only, not the Gentiles. He hasn't gone that far yet. So.
Yeah, okay. But because we support Israel, there's obviously a tension there between... But could the media play a better role in portraying Middle Easterners in this country?
Excellent point. But the media, as you know very well, is not monolithic in the U.S. So, the media, I think, deserves a lot of credit, particularly serious media like Washington Post, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, in dispelling a lot of these misconceptions. And you know, on the other hand, you have, you know, some much more kind of right-wing conservative media that's really is very, very denigrating to these populations.
And the mass media that most of the people watch, most of the stuff they watch on television isn't the news, isn't, NewsHour on PBS. It is some reality show coming out of New Jersey.
Right. But there's also a body of works that these Middle Eastern Americans produce that are quite popular. I mean, everybody remembers The Kite Runner. The novel that was very popular and the movie or reading Lolita from Tehran, you know, and mm-hmm. that it was also on the New York Times bestsellers list, I understand. So there's plenty of materials out there to educate yourself. It's not that there's any shortage of materials. In fact, this population is very articulate. This population produces a lot between the Iranian memoirs and Arab American poetry and that is indigenous and second and third generation. There's no shortage of material that is produced by these. And I would say that probably one of the most exciting this work is very exciting. It's their time to tell their story, but it's this story is not being told because it's sometimes subverted by the news hour and by the local conflict in the Middle East that somehow impacts these communities here. So I would just we talk about conflict again. You know, Ahmadinejad and this and that, but let's look at what these populations are producing themselves, and let's hear it from their own. Through their own words, you know.
Well, what about your second question? You had the second question.
Well, I was just going to comment on that. Was going to say that, unfortunately, though, Ahmadinejad seems to be the voice head or the spokesperson for the Middle East. I mean, we never hear from other premiers or leaders of other countries in a more positive way. It just seems like the media, anytime you hear anything from the Middle East, it's usually in a negative sense coming from Iran.
Yeah, your point is very well taken, and I think you're absolutely right in the sense that it is, if the focus is on conflict, you know, and also the problem with conflict is that it's not conducive to deliberation and communication and conversation like we are having right now. A conflict, you know, the sort of the emotions are flared up and the irrationality takes over. So it's really, but you're absolutely right about that.
Well, my second question is, In my opinion, and I live in the northern part of Columbus in a very diverse area. But when there are people from different cultures who have come to America, I see that they st- for what it is. I know they come here for a better life. Most of them that do are, as you said, educated. They're intelligent. They're looking for a better, but they stay within their own people. I think that sometimes, and I know I'll go off here on, for example, the Hispanic population, because just like not learning English as a first language, and then the political parts that come in there. I just wonder why that is. Is it because they're just more comfortable, or?
Well, let's find out, because the way you're describing it to me, David, is the way it's always been with new immigrant populations. But let's hear from Mehdi first.
Well, you know, you already said one aspect of it is the psychological comfort. But actually, interestingly, you know, the contrary to sort of the thinking, the assimilationist sort of thinking, there's a lot of research that comes, the new research coming out of the academia that suggests that groups that do stay together by drawing on each other's network and social capital, they actually do better. You know, so it's not that they're not, eventually they're going to kind of get integrated, that it takes time and it takes generations, you know, but this notion of sort of like being insular and clannish, you know, and again, in the case of Middle Easterners, you have to bear in mind that one thing that deters these groups from becoming integrated is discrimination and prejudice, you know.
You also have to remember that these the Middle Eastern American communities have not formed ethnic enclaves, for example, like Chinatowns or Little Armenias. Of course, they exist, but they've not formed these kind of ghettoized or ethnic enclaves. And part of it, that's not to mean that they don't communicate, but they communicate differently. They communicate through media, they communicate through newspapers, and communicate through their own networks. But they haven't formed this kind of cohesive neighborhoods that you can see elsewhere. And part of it is because they come with skills, you know. So they come with, you know, as professionals, they come as educated, they speak the language well,
right,
so they don't kind of form these enclaves. And the second generation or third generation go beyond. So it's an interesting study of immigrants who have not formed ethnic enclaves. At the same time, who have become very assimilated, and at the same time have also retained their culture. And the culture is something that appeals to Americans at large, from cuisine to dance. You know, it's part of our. It's part of who, what America is all about, you know.
Thanks a lot, David, for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Real quickly from Sam on Facebook, before we take a break, maybe just reiterate a little bit. He says, I have a Lebanese friend whose family has lived here since before the Civil War. So I'm wondering if your guests could touch on how long Arabs and other peoples from the Middle East have been emigrating to the United States. So that goes way back.
Yeah, it goes way back. And I think that... I think the first immigrant is Antonio Bisciolani, who was buried at the Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, who came here as a missionary, I think before the Civil War. But there are very few Lebanese who have come that early. I think the large migration started in the 1870s and accelerated thereafter. The mother colony in Little Syria was established
in New York.
In New York, and it stood not far away from the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
Sadly, and just it's a couple of buildings still remain. And I think there's a celebration of the history of Little Syria. But there were Little Syrias all around the United States. But New York was the mother colony. But they were also assimilated very quickly. There were merchants who fanned out throughout the the East Coast and
peddlers,
and became very, very assimilated. You know, we have a
peddling. If I may add something, yeah. I mean that is a very, very important story, because peddling took them, you know, on the road,
mm-hmm.
and also because there was a shortage of female migrants, you know, they intermarried. So the intermarriage among the early waves of Arab Americans is very, very substantial. So you have now people who are third, fourth generation that don't look at all, you know, Arab, but they're, you know, Arab American. So
if you want to learn more about Middle Eastern Americans, we have a website that was produced through City University of New York and UCLA. It's called Miro, M-E-A-R-O, www.miro.org. Miro stands for Middle Eastern American Resources Online. And you can get all this information, including census reports and documentaries, and through this website.
Well, we'll try to get the link to that website posted on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to talk about, take it just a little bit, topic a little bit tighter, and talk about raising children if you're an immigrant from the Middle East. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Romney writes off the 47% and does damage control on Fox, while the president pays a visit to Letterman and Bill O'Reilly and Jon Stewart get set to rumble in the air-conditioned auditorium. I'm Neil Conan. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, joins us with the 47% fallout and a look at Senate races across the country. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour 2 of All Sides with Ann Fisher, and the intersection of poverty and drugs in Appalachia, a fictional account and the real deal, that discussion from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. 54 degrees with sunshine, warming up to 67 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 46. More sunshine and warmer with a high of 75 on Thursday. Partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain Thursday night, a low of 54. Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
So, what of the parents of Middle Eastern American children? How do parents of immigrant children in general guide them at home, in their values, in school, with friends and family, and in faith? Still with us is sociologist Dr. Mehdi Borzorgmer. He's founder and co-director of the Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Once again, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And Jonathan Friedlander, assistant director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Once again, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
And joining us now by phone is Dr. Bhagwan Sadiani. He is medical director of the Vascular Laboratory at the OSU Wexner Medical Center and author of a new book called An American Journey, Life Lessons for Parents of Immigrant Children. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In your introduction to the book, you write that your experiences as a South Asian immigrant may be somewhat unique, but that you believe the lessons in your book apply to most, if not all, immigrants to the United States or other Western countries. Can you expand on that? How so?
Well, I think, you know, I thought when I started to write this book, parenting is a challenge no matter where you are or what background. But I think being an immigrant has special twists and turns. And I think the acculturation stresses that we experience are added on top of the normal parenting stresses. And so, you know, a lot of the immigrant children, people call them involuntary immigrants because, of course, they're children. And they're often called exiles because they don't come of their own free will. The parents drag them here, of course. And so, you know, I think for them and the parents, the push and pull of the freedom, which is often a two-edged sword here, you know, we come here because of freedom. And yet the kids look at us and say, well, yeah, but what about my freedom, the way I grew up here and the culture that I'm experiencing? So there's this clash in the family about values, about faith, about families, marriage, the home, the friends they keep. I mean, parenting in general, of course, is a challenge, but I think immigrants have a special burden. And so this book talks about parents, how to deal with the stresses that we experience, whether it's food or clothing or privacy. I think this, hopefully my experience will help, you know, all immigrants.
It sort of, the way you describe it, takes the "I didn't ask to be born" assertion of most kids to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
In your opinion, given the times we live in, might there be special problems for parents of Middle Eastern American children?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's a little different because, you know, I think especially after 9/11, there's even an extra layer or burden imposed on them, especially if they happen to be Islamic. I think that's an extra burden that they have to educate their children about, especially when it's dealing with faith. And I think the old thing, you know, where a first generation comes and tells their children, well, this is the way it is, or this is the way the imam says it is, well, the children are not going to buy it anymore looking here. So I have a whole section on faith and how to introduce the children, how to do it in a way that they will accept living in the United States. And we can't forget our faith, no matter what it is. So there's a gentler way to really introduce them. And, you know, I think the parents are used to doing this.
Mehdi Borzagmer, what in your opinion is the difference now for kids of Middle Eastern nationalities, ethnicities, parents? Is it just a 9/11 issue, or is a little bit more to it than that?
Well, I mean, as was mentioned, I think 9/11 looms very large in their minds because there's this issue of particularly when you're in school, the taunting from classmates, you know, this is a really big, big problem. The
bullying.
Bullying and so on and so forth. And I think this approach, which is really very interesting, there's a huge body of work on the children of immigrants, as a second generation, but rarely have I seen something that actually gives parenting lessons. And I think this is a really, really wonderful book, and I look forward to reading it. I just saw it today. But I think that this really looms very large in their mind. You know, there's always this other issue of success. I mean, this is a very big the drive, the pushing, you know, these kids to really, really excel and all that entails, you know, and that is really especially, you know, sort of valuing a lucrative, you know, sort of education and career.
The American dream.
Well, you know, but particularly coming from Middle Eastern countries where, you know, the issues of being a doctor, an engineer, you know, are really status symbols. So pushing people into those fields where they don't want to necessarily go into it, you know, and the negotiation that takes place there.
Yeah. Jonathan Friedlander?
Yeah. I think that a different angle is it's also really about identity here, you know, a second generation and remaining who you are. And what are the measures? How do you preserve your identity through social institutions, cultural institutions, language preservation, intermarriage? For Israeli Americans, for example, the issue is striking because you know, you marry out. You know, for Iranian Jews, you keep insular. You know, so Arab Americans and Iranian Americans, how do they maintain their identity? Is language the key issue here? Is it cultural institutions? Is it cuisine? Is it memory?
Again, this is a sort of a challenging issue because the problem of preserving identity, when your identity can potentially be a liability, you know, not necessarily an advantage. You see, this is really a very hard thing to come
others in. Have gone before, ultimately. I mean, you know, the Germans in World War I.
Right.
They were shutting down the breweries in Columbus. Yes. I mean, the bars were getting shut down, and there's a place called German Village in Columbus. And
we went to it.
Of course, you know, think people move on. The enclaves, you know, scatter, as you described earlier. But the culture, in and of itself, eventually is going to be subsumed to a certain degree, won't it?
Yeah, I think that, but there's a difference. And okay. as we discuss in our book, we have a chapter on this issue where we compare the post 9/11 backlash against historical precedents, mm-hmm. such as the Germans during First World War, Japanese during the Second World War, and so on and so forth. And the difference is that the sort of the American society today, you know, is a bit much more multicultural. They're not the same kind of assimilation, you know, sort of machines that were in existence when the Germans, you know, were targeted. And these populations, you know, actually are asserting themselves more. They're organizing more. They're educating the public more. They're mobilizing, you know, and they're integrating. They're sort of, I think that is a very interesting opportunity, you know, for these groups, you know, to...
And can I make a
comment? Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you had to say, you know, what three things stood out for me as an immigrant parent, I mean, the big changes that the burden I brought with me is, one, the paternalistic culture that I came from, two, I would have to say dealing with failure, and three, risk-taking. Mm-hmm. I mean, those latter two are so American. In the immigrant community where I came from, I mean, that's why one of the participants was talking about is that you have to go into this profession, being a physician or this or that, because it's so safe. We're not used to dealing with failure or risk-taking. And this is the thing you'd struggle with kids now, my kids. You say, go do it. Yes, it's a risk, but this is America. You can succeed. This is absolutely the way. So I think for us, those are things that we wrestle with, and I think those are the lessons we can teach other parents dealing with it. This is the United States. And if I can quote Tocqueville, as everybody knows, you know, the French aristocrat, and I point out, I think he said, in America where the privileges of birth never existed and where riches confer no peculiar rights on their possessors, men unacquainted with each other are very ready to frequent the same places and find neither peril nor advantage in a free interchange of their thoughts. I mean, to me, it's the freedom of being able, as a religious minority where I come from, the freedom to say what's on your mind and not be reprimanded or whatever. I mean, that's a big, big thing for me. So.
And is that sometimes with parents who came from another place hard to explain to their kids who grew up in the United States?
Very hard.
But it's important that the kids understand that, too.
Correct. I think that's the extra burden of parenting. You are kind of playing it safe, no risk taking, go here, go do that, and the kids rebel. I mean, you saw in the movie The Namesake.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw that movie.
Yeah, so,
The Namesake, and read the book by Jim Palari. I mean, this is classic rebellion by immigrant children against their parents. And of course, in the movie, it had a good ending, but life is not like that. But I think that's the struggle the immigrant parents are going through.
If you have a question or comment, we have a few more minutes. Give us a call right now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what about immigrants who arrive here as older children? How does the whole dynamic change for them, Dr. Sadiani?
Yeah, I think that is a little different. I think the younger children, I think, obviously, easy to bring up and bring along. The older children, I think, have a much more difficult time. I've got friends that have come in with, you know, 14, 15-year-olds, and they've already gone to school there. The language, they have an accent. You know, it is harder for them, and the parents just have to work much harder. I mean, like one of the speakers was saying today, you know, the accent and the clothes and the food, everything comes into play. So it's a little harder for the older children. But, you know, that's where we are. We're a melting pot, and I think parents just bear down and see what they can do, have the kids adjust.
You know, there are still stories in the United States about parents punishing their daughters for disobeying them. They're going against their culture, going against their faith. And that's not something we really embrace in the United States. It's a freedom of you know, religion, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. I wonder sometimes when you hear about those really horrible stories of punishment, if the parents knew what they were getting into when they moved here, or maybe they didn't have a choice.
I know several parents who took their, particularly when they had daughters, took their daughters back to their home countries. And I know several who were threatening to do that never ended up doing that for their own reasons. And I said before, I think it's you know, for women, for girls growing up here, it's a very much more difficult situation. And I'd like to hear from the other participants. I think for girls growing up, it's much more difficult. The structure is more rigid, and there's less flexibility there.
Ironically, the girls do better education-wise than the boys here. Studies show that.
Yes. Correct.
Interesting.
Correct.
But there are also those incidents that you describe of sometimes end up in violence, and that's when we come in, I think, both the UCLA Center and Center at City University of New York, you know, expert witnesses, and so we it can be explained and not approved, but at least understand the cultural issues behind these acts. Not that we justify any of it, of course, but it's more complicated than that. And of course, I think also it depends on education, on where you come from, whether you come from the city or you come from the country, a villager versus urban. So it's much more complicated than just what we hear.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Jonathan Friedlander. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Friedlander, he's Assistant Director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Also, Dr. Mehdi Borzoghmer, he's Professor of Sociology, founding co-director of the Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center at the City University of New York Graduate Center.
Also, thanks to the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Ohio State University that make it possible. Thank
okay.
you so much.
And Dr. Borzoghmer, thank you for
thank
joining
you so
us.
Thank you so much, Anne.
And Dr. Bhagwan Sadiani, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dr. Bhagwan Sadiani, he's author, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called An American Journey, Life Lessons for Parents of Immigrant Children. He's also medical director of the vascular laboratory at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.